Great. And it looks like everybody is here. So welcome. And I understand that there is an agreement about splitting time for argument on the side of appellants, because I know we have a brief both from the county as well as from the guardian ad litem here. So do you want to tell me what
Yes, Your Honor.
that
Yes, Your
agreement
Honor.
is?
Thank you. That's correct. Mr. Brusilovsky and I have agreed to split the initial time, and he will take the last 3 minutes.
Okay, and Ms. Johnston, you're arguing on behalf of the county
Yep.
then?
Yes, Your
Okay,
Honor.
and Mr. Brusilovsky, you are
That's
representing Ms. Stratton, correct?
that's
Guardian ad
the
litem.
honor.
Okay. All right. Okay. Well, we'll get started. As you know, and you're probably very well used to by now, we are conducting this oral argument by Zoom. An audio recording will be available on our website later on today, I believe. As you no doubt also know, 15 minutes of argument for each side with 5 minutes of rebuttal for the appellant. And if anybody has any technical issues at any time, let us know. If you can't hear any of us, you're having problems, just let us know. And we can stop the clock and figure things out and make sure things are working smoothly. So with that, Marshall, do you want to call our second case on our oral calendar today?
Yes, calling case A20-1458 in the matter of the welfare of the children of R.T. and
All
J.T.
right,
Parent.
and what we're going to do with our newly installed fancier timing mechanism, we used to require our law clerks to hold up their cell phones, is that she is going to split the time. So 12 minutes for the county, and then there'll be a separate timer of 3 minutes for Mr. Brusilovsky. So with that, please, as you start your argument, identify yourself and then proceed. Ms. Johnston.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning to all of you. May it please the court. I'm Assistant Hennepin County Attorney Elizabeth Johnston, and I represent the appellant, Hennepin County Human Services and Public Health Department. The department respectfully requests this court to reverse the district court's denial of the termination of parental rights in this matter and to impose said termination. In my argument this morning, I hope to expand on several points that are also raised in my brief and, of course, answer any questions that the court might have. At core, and I think what is right up front in the department's brief, is that this matter, this case, this appeal is based in the record. It is a long record. There are more than 1,000 pages of documentary exhibits. And there was 4 full days or almost full days of testimony that the district court heard. The problem is that many of the district court's pertinent factual findings in the order it issued subsequently are clearly erroneous, either because they are simply contradicted by the testimony in the record or because they ignore so much of the evidence as to be not reasonably supported by the record as a whole and thus clearly erroneous. The record is, as I mentioned, large. So I'd like to highlight a couple of factual examples that are not by any means the extent of it, but I think are particularly problematic with respect to the court's findings and ultimate conclusion regarding denying the termination of parental rights. The basic issue from the parents here, due to the condition of the home, which was variously described as a hoarder's home, as not having clear pathways, as having dirty diapers and feces, as having animal urine and feces, as having rotting food in the refrigerator, over years and over repeated efforts to remedy that. Additionally, the behaviors of the parents, namely Mr. Thompson's, excuse me,
Ms.
anger issues.
I don't mean to cut you off, but we have 8.5 minutes and I think a lot of ground to cover. I mean, it is an extensive record and the court appreciates the thorough briefing and the citations to the record. I mean, it seems clear to me since RT's mother died and they've had to live independently that it has been difficult for this family, no question about it. And I see, you know, throughout the record, a number of services offered and the district court kind of time and time again, since the CHIPS proceeding started in 2017, saying these services aren't good enough. They're not the right kind of thing for these people. And we can argue about that. And I think, you know, the evidence goes both ways, but I guess, what is it in this record that should have persuaded the district court and should persuade us to reverse, even under our standard of review, that TPR is required because these parents cannot ever live independently?
Well, and Your Honor, that is actually one thing that I thank you for asking the question, because I would like to clarify a little bit of that. The issue is not so much that the parents must be able to live entirely independently or parent entirely independently. It is that they must be able to parent. If they need support, then they must be willing to accept and use and maintain those supports. And that is what this record has repeatedly demonstrated.
But
they are unwilling
to
do.
I'm trying to figure out, and again, the record's extensive, and they have had a lot of parenting time. And, you know, I think that the department agrees that in terms of their interaction with the children, that's where they've focused their energies, and they have demonstrated increasing ability to have good interactions. And I know it's been tough, but there's been good support from the department on that. But have they ever had a chance to have, for example, unsupervised parenting time in their home or overnights or any of those sort of incremental steps that would have assured this district court that in fact they weren't able to make the progress?
Well, not particularly, and not for lack of trying by the district court. I think one of the things that I would note that is an inaccurate statement in respondent's brief is that there was a trial home visit. There was not ever a trial home visit. The district court throughout this case continued to offer carrots to the parents in the form of increased visits, increased unsupervised visits, the option of perhaps an over in the near future, provided certain things were met. And none of those things were ever met, and such a trial home visit overnights never actually occurred. There were unsupervised visits ordered. The department and the guardians for both children, but Ms. Stratton objected to those unsupervised visits because of the lack of progress in the parents' parenting capabilities. And in the other aspects of their case plan, which were designed to help them understand where their deficits were and internalize the need to accept assistance and services on an ongoing basis. Those things never happened. And so as they objected to the unsupervised visits, what they did to try and mitigate those concerns was to have other services happen at the same time. So the parenting education with Ms. Menti that remained also occurred around that time. The parenting work that was done with St. David's occurred at a similar time. But so really there was no progress past some unsupervised visits over the course of this case.
And do you agree with, I think, the district court's assessment that for the most part, the parents did comply with the requirements of their respective case plans, understanding that they had not secured housing and that father had not done anger management and was just beginning individual therapy along that. But other than that, they had agree with that finding.
I disagree with that, Your Honor, and I think that's touched on in our brief as well. The requirement was that the parents maintain safe and suitable housing. the housing that they maintained during the course of the case was not safe when they were in charge of maintaining it at any point. The parenting worker who was most frequently in the home, Ms. Menti, testified repeatedly that they would make little bits of improvement after they had a massive cleaning session, and then it would revert to the same concerning conditions. Budgeting so that hopefully they would be able to pay their bill and not be evicted. That didn't work. They were not able to maintain having a home. They did, after they were, I guess, not officially evicted after the efforts of the department, but asked to leave their apartment, they moved in with Mr. Thompson's mother and sister. Ms. Menti, they had not been there for long at the beginning of trial. Ms. Menti testified that the upstairs level where the whole family was did appear to be cleaner and safer, but that she was not able to speak to the conditions of the basement where the parents were residing. The other services, such as there's sort of a panoply of mental health services that the parents were asked to participate, individual therapy, anger management. What happened repeatedly throughout the case was that the parents would, after much prodding or after a court hearing, agree to start something, and then it would trickle off. Nothing ever progressed. Nothing ever finished.
And that's consistent, is it not, with the parents' challenges and disabilities? I mean, that's what I think the district court struggled with, and I frankly do too. It's like, how can they be expected to comply with services that are outside?
Well, and so the piece is that they need to be able to show up. And that was what they were not. And there is something of a circle there. But at some point, the child protection system is not the avenue for holding an adult who's not under a guardianship, for forcing their hand in particular services. What the child protection system can do is try to provide a case manager, provide a DD manager. And then when those things do not work, they have to act in the best interests of the children. I'll turn to Mr. Brusilowski.
Yes, good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court.
Wait, hold on 1 second. Oh, okay, timer's on, go ahead.
Thank you very much, Your Honors. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Alex Brusilowski, and I represent Mrs. Catherine Stratton, who is the guardian ad litem for the two youngest children in this proceeding. Given the time allotted to me today, I will try to be brief. I should begin by saying that Mrs. Stratton is a dedicated professional with an extensive involvement in this case. And she has made her position clear that it is her strong opinion that termination of the parental rights of both parents is in the best interests of the two youngest children. Mrs. Stratton supports the department's position and the department's appeal. She opined that the children need a consistent and reliable caregiver who is able to meet the children's special needs on a permanent basis. Mrs. Stratton further opined that the parents were not able to provide the level of care that these children need. The record is replete with examples of how the parents were not able to meet the needs of the children. And the lack of ability on the part of the parents to care for the children is not due to a lack of love, but it is due to their own developmental disabilities, which the district court acknowledged in its decision.
May I ask you one question? Is it your position that termination of parental rights is required whenever a parent is unable to independently care for their children?
Well, I think, Yana, it is facts specific, and we cannot say such situation, but I think that in this particular situation, it is required. And if I may continue, the district court acknowledged the parents' disabilities, but it has taken the position that can essentially be characterized that the parents must be provided with extraordinary efforts to allow them to parent their children. But that, however, is not the law. The law only requires reasonable efforts to reunify the parents and the children, not endless efforts, not all conceivable and not all possible efforts. When the district court requires the efforts of reunification to continue, regardless of how they were not fruitful in the past, that results in an exceedingly prolonged proceeding that we have here, which delays permanency for the children. And this case has already exceeded all timelines for a permanency proceeding, and the children continue to be in the limbo. And Mrs. Stratton takes a position that that just simply goes against the best interests of the children. And conceivably, these parents could, I'm sorry if I am out of time, I don't know if the court wishes me to finish.
All right, any questions for Mr. Brusilovsky? No, all right. Then Mr. Mara, you're gonna have to help me with your name, Mara Vigli?
That's Mara Vili, silent G, Your Honor.
Vili, that's what I should have gone for, but at any rate, did not. So if you, whenever you're ready, go ahead and start and just introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Paul Mara Vili. I represent mother and father in this case, RT and JT. To begin, I think I'd like to, refer to the record to respond directly to some of the points made by department counsel by going to a hearing in June of 2019 presided over by Judge Norris. It was the one time he appeared on this case. I was struck by the several references to Judge Norris made in the department's reply brief, but I looked at the transcript of that hearing again, and I think that there were some statements that Judge Norris made that really address what's going on here. First, at that hearing on June 7th of 2019, department counsel admitted that to that point in the case, 2 years on, they had received no negative reports in any of the unsupervised visits. That's on page 32. When Judge Norris finally weighed in on the record, his first comment to the department was to tell them to stop speculating about home dangers and get a factual basis before the court. That was on page 37. He said his review of the record in the very limited time that he had showed that the department had set up, in his words, way too many appointments for these parents. That it was up to the department to set prioritization to assist parents with demonstrative cognitive limitations. Judge Norris noted that this schedule at this point in 2019 would challenge and overwhelm anyone. And he wondered aloud why the arms worker hadn't at least tried to help with scheduling instead of dealing or trying to focus on financial matters.
And yet, as I review, I'm not certain if it's the order from that hearing or maybe it was an August 2019 hearing. I believe Judge Norris made a finding that the department had made reasonable efforts. I believe that the court made that express finding, notwithstanding the comments you've just shared.
Had still not gotten his diagnostic assessment. He also noted that JT himself, the father, had not gotten a completed assessment at that point. I think once those were done and reported back to the court, he recognized that the services that the department was asking the parents to participate in were what was needed at the time, but it wasn't meant to be a final determination as to, you know, how to get these kids to where the department focused in their reply brief to permanency. That's what Judge Dawson had to deal with again when she came back to the case.
I'd like to ask you more broadly about the reasonable efforts finding, because it seems to me as I read the district court's order denying the termination petition, the court really focused on the failure to provide one particular service, namely the kindred family focus program. As I understand the law, the failure to provide one specific service doesn't render an agency's efforts overall unreasonable. Am I right about that?
It depends, I think, Your Honor, because I think the juvenile court was not basing or hinging the reasonable efforts finding solely on that. And if I could support that with more citations to the record, I wanted to point out that the order from Judge Dawson in January of 2019, which is in my addendum, pointed out that trial home visits were actually authorized. They were ordered in August of 2018, but that certain conditions and services to be provided by the department were still pending. So those unsupervised trial home visits and overnight visits were supposed to happen 2 years before the trial began. So I think that the reason that the juvenile court found the Kindred situation so frustrating was that based on the way the description was finally given, and it wasn't completely given until near the end of the trial by the department, it seemed like something that could have addressed all of the issues. And the juvenile court also had a problem.
But as I understand the record, I think because the court, in fact, directed the department to go explore the availability of that program, and wasn't the assessment or the information conveyed back to Ms. Love, the social worker, that this wasn't the kind of program that's necessarily appropriate for entire families of adult parents, you know, and that there weren't, in fact, any appropriate homes available at this time?
What Ms. Love testified to and what was in her affidavit was that it wasn't a typical situation, but the department never asserted that this program was unavailable or completely inappropriate for this family. They said that it would take some difficulty to try to fit this program with this particular family. But no, Your Honor, it was never something that just couldn't work. The thing that the juvenile court was also struck by was Ms. Love's attempt in her testimony to make it sound like the parents were involved in the vetting of this program and the decision not to pursue it. They weren't. Ms. Love admitted she'd never personally told them about it. And as I pointed out in my brief, the pre-hearing reports from 2018 pointed out that the department had looked at it, but there's nothing in the record to show the parents were ever even told about it. So I think the juvenile court felt like the fact that the trial home visits couldn't happen between August of 2018 and January 2019 because the parents were still missing services, that's the umbrella aspect of her reasonable efforts finding, Judge. If the department would have involved the parents and spent the 2 years from August of 2018 until the time of trial trying to get them fit into a Kindred house and program, it would have been better to try that than to just write it off. The position that I've taken in this appeal is that the department, as I think the juvenile court saw, did not work in a way that was meant to help this particular family achieve reunification.
Well, I don't know that one can say that. I mean, I think that it was fits and starts to try to deal with the myriad of issues facing this family. And certainly the services, the DD services, the ARM services were tailored toward some of the needs. I'm just wondering, how long does an agency need to continue supporting a family? Under the district court's order, I mean, will they be under CHIP supervision till the children are all emancipated?
I would respond to that, Judge, by pointing out that Judge Dawson's point in this case was that she wondered when the department was finally going to give this family the services that they actually needed. Using the example of the DD management, which somehow JT, the father, was never found to qualify for, when according to his testing, he was more cognitively challenged than the mother. The fact that all he did was say, I don't think I need anger management, and he was told that he wouldn't get the services. This doesn't make any sense. And he gets faulted for that. I would like to just point out that I've worked in a treatment court for over a decade now. And when people are referred for a chemical health assessment, when they say they don't think they need it, that's not a deal breaker. The only time they're not given a referral is if they say they aren't using. JT has never tried to argue, nor could he, that he's had some angry outbursts here. But the fact that all he had to do was say, I don't think anger management is, I don't think I need it, and he gets sent packing, that's not a responsive process. It's not a responsive procedure. What should have happened was that he referred anyway, because denial is the primary component of people dealing with issues such as anger management or chemical abuse. So the juvenile court's reasonable efforts finding were not based on the fact that the department had consistently provided the efforts, you know, and had just not been precise enough. As I've hopefully shown in the orders I attached to my brief, this family continually went without resources, things as simple as a lock for the back door or a ramp in front of their apartment in 2018 that foster families get immediately. Judge Dawson was perplexed by the fact that all of the foster families got all of the services that they needed, but during the course of the case plan, and that's what we're talking about here, not prior to 2017, this family either didn't get it or it was very delayed. Assessments were delayed. Okay, JTG wasn't finally and fully, first he was assessed as having autism. Then they did another assessment and found, well, that was a mistake. All this happened or was done by the end of 2019, right before trial. If the department's efforts were tailored and assiduous enough, why did this take so long? That's what Judge Norris was wondering in June of 2019, and that's what Judge Dawson continually wondered. And I did include her December 10th order in my brief, and I do think it has bearing here, because she just gave a very brief denial of a new trial or amended findings order. And I think she used the December 10th order to explain her rationale as to why, no, the record won't be opened. And yes, these kids need to go back to their parents. And I think that that particular order contains a wealth of information about the deficiency.
The kids may qualify for services, but what are the county's obligations with respect to the parents? I mean, that ends, right? The case is over.
Well, it's not over, Judge. They're still under a CHIPS designation, and that's what it reverted to. Mainly because, again, the parents were still needing help as far as getting services that this court has recognized they're eligible to get and they should get when they have this. Everybody agreed, even Ms. Menti, that the mother's home that they got on their own was safe housing. It was clean. And the department is relentlessly focusing here on the housing conditions that existed around 2017, 2018.
Did Ms. Mentis or Ms. Love ever gain access to the home in its entirety?
Ms. Menti testified directly to her knowing that the house was safe. I do think it's also important to point out that not only do these parents have cognitive limitations, but they live in poverty. And it's not uncommon at all for parents who have children who are living in poverty, having difficulty maintaining, you know, housing up to code. Dealing with things. See, there are so many families that can afford services on their own. That basic things like daycare, maybe a housekeeper, lawn care and home repair, even a babysitter. None of those were options for these parents. They had all they could do to hold down jobs. They got no help from the landlords in some of the substandard buildings they were living in. At one point, as the juvenile court pointed out, they found a 3-bedroom apartment on their own, which the department first which, by the way, the department had provided foster families before, but somehow it didn't happen with this family. So I feel like in the last 2 years, this court has already dealt with three very similar cases to this one that started on the same basis, low functioning parents. I've cited them in my brief. The Children of BM case, which was published, and then the welfare of SDT and the welfare of ECS cases. In each instance, the department sought termination of parental rights for a parent who was low cognitive functioning. But in all those cases, the TPR was reversed because it was found that these parents, despite their limitations cognitively and financially, assiduously attended parenting education. Even though, as they were found to have, I think it was in the SDT case or ECS, to still only have a rudimentary knowledge, it was their diligent pursuit of visitation and parenting that showed that TPR was not justified, that a person's inability to grasp the elements and components of parenting education, to recite it back, to do it all without prompts and reminders, as the department has relentlessly asserted here, is not good enough.
I want to ask you to change your focus for a moment. My concern in reviewing several times the district court's order, I'm left with a question about whether the district court treated the best interests of the children, as opposed to the parents' rights, the best interests of the children as paramount consideration. Where would you point me to as evidence that in fact the district court did place the children's best interests above the other concerns?
That parents are every visit, which the parents missed virtually none of, nothing but love and care was shown. They showed the ability to parent these children. The department, as Judge Norris pointed out, kept pointing out dangers that didn't exist. And the juvenile court recognized that if it had been, you know, up to the department, they would have been staying with them much longer. But at that point, they were limited by what was being given. The best interests of the children were to be with the parents who had shown how dedicated they were to being their parents without ever having any incidents of harm or neglect reported throughout the case plan in all the time they had with them. I guess I'm out of time. Thank you very much.
Okay, Ms. Johnston, rebuttal when you're ready.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to start right there at the end with that best interest piece. I think that Your Honor has identified a big problem here, that the district court throughout this case has viewed her role as advocating for the parents and the parents' rights, and has done so to the detriment of the children's health, safety, welfare, and best interests. And the law recognizes explicitly in the best interest category, but frankly, even in the overarching statements of the purposes of the child welfare statutes, that where the children's health, safety, welfare, competing interests contradict those of the parent, that those competing interests trump. And that is what we have here. I think the district court is, and all of us are confronted with what is certainly a frustrating circumstance, that there are voluntary services and there are involuntary services. Involuntary services through the child welfare system are necessarily by statute and because these involve adults, not intended to be prolonged. There are timelines attached which relate to the children's best interests, but also to the recognition that adults get to make decisions. They get to decide not to do things, even when it would be a better idea to do them, or even when it would be to their children's benefit for them to do them. That's what has happened here. There has never been an unavailability of services to these parents. The department has repeatedly come back and come back and come back with new referrals, with new suggestions, with new avenues to approach the same challenges. The problem is—
One more minute to the best interest thing. What role does the existence of a potential adoptive placement or a foster care placement make in a court's best interest analysis?
Respectfully, I don't think it should make much. Certainly if there is a placement waiting, I suppose that might be persuasive. But the question is whether the parents are able to be that placement, are able to be that resource and that caregiver. The department cannot move forward with particular, you know, either speed or efficacy in really recruiting an appropriate permanency resource. Sometimes until there is a termination, not everybody wants to step up until that happens. So there's so much that is after the fact that really, I think it's important to focus on, can the parents do it? That's the question that we are tasked with examining and that best interest is tasked with approaching. Voluntary services remain available to these parents. The problem is that they don't want them. They don't believe they need them. They don't understand them to be necessary. Ms. Thompson and Mr. Thompson both testified to that. JT, Mr. Thompson was not denied anger management services. Rather, when he participated in his evaluation and said, I don't have any issues, the evaluator said, well, you can come back, but if he's not able to acknowledge a need for something, not much progress is going to be made. That's something that the department's ongoing presence can't really fix. This sort of, I don't need these services, I don't want these services, as the district court frankly recognized, I am too proud to think that I need something different than other people, and so I don't want to do that. That is the obstacle here. And the department spent really 5 years on a voluntary out-of-court basis and then almost 3 years in court under court orders with the assistance of multiple judges saying, hey, let's try this. Hey, let's do this. We do need this. If you can keep this up, we can get somewhere. And the parents don't want to do it. They didn't make progress in the kinds of parenting improvements and understanding of their children's needs that allow them to be safe without services. And they've said they don't want services on a voluntary basis. We cannot continue in this involuntary, coercive, court-ordered posture. I would also note, I would encourage the court to look carefully at what is within the record properly. If we're looking at whether the kids have returned home, things of that nature, there's a whole lot that has come after that, and it simply is not part of the question of whether at the time of trial, these parents were able to be the safe and adequate caregivers that their children require. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much. Thank you both for your arguments and briefs. They've been very helpful to us, and we will be issuing a decision within the statutory time period. So thank you all. And that concludes this.